Now it is my pleasure to introduce one of my closest friends. I have known him for over 20 years. We've been through a lot together. He's an amazing person, has an amazing program. So with that, I'll give you Jay.
Wow. I'm Jay. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. I'm also happy, joyous, and free today. I found that here. So I look forward to sharing that with you, but I know I need to qualify myself first. So my sobriety date is November 22nd, 2012. And I haven't sought fit to take anything mind-altering since that date. And that is a true miracle. And only by the grace of God and you guys has that been possible. Really, the answer is you guys. I found God through you guys. Got sober through you guys until I could get a God. And now it's God who does keep me sober daily, along with you guys. I'd like to make daily calls to at least 3 to 5 of you guys every day, if not more. The program has become my life. I live the program. It saved my life. What I'll do is I'll get started to talk about my experience. And then I will share my strength of what happened and what the hope is of what it's like now. But one of my favorite things to do now is smile. So I like to see the effect it has on people, want to interact with people, and that wasn't the case when I got here. Okay, I mean, this is serious business, but I'm happy to report that one of my favorite things to do now is smile. So I hope that is your experience too, and it's just what a blessing. So I was born in Detroit in 1973, little town called Detroit, and I don't remember a whole lot of Detroit other than my dad worked for American Motors, so we had a lot of those ugly cars. Back in the day, we had the Gremlin, we had the wooden-sided station wagon, the Jeep Eagle, the first four-wheel drive, very ugly vehicle. And my dad got a different vehicle every single year, so I thought that was pretty neat. We grew up with a lot of snow. My memories of Detroit were grew up going to Cub Scouts. You know, my dad at that time, I felt like he just kind of drank some beers. You know, didn't really notice it too much as a young kid. I graduated into seeing what that would look like when I got older. We were also in Indian Guides, which I don't know if any of you know, remember that whole program, but it was kind of a spinoff on the Cub Scouts where you did a lot of Native American culture stuff. And so instead of getting badges, you had like a little leather vest and you would add stuff to it. It was pretty neat. Very, very cool growing up doing that, hunting and fishing with my dad. That's how I grew up in Michigan. We moved to Ohio when I was in fifth grade. I kind of left everything, all my friends that I had at that point that I grew up with. And it was kind of hard on me and my sister, but my dad made a power move to Ohio, where I grew up the rest of the way in Canton, Ohio. There's two things that people do really well in Canton, Ohio is drink and fight. That's kind of what I moved into from Detroit, as I can kind of tell you how that transition worked. But at that point in time, you know, I started to notice some things were definitely different about my family. My dad had started to drink every day. He came from a long line of alcoholics. I would know that when we would go visit his family. When we would go to Chicago to visit both sides of the family, we would stay with my dad's side of the family for less than 24 hours, if we were lucky to even spend the night. And then we spent the rest of the time with my mom's side of the family, who is the Italian side of the family, who could have an occasional glass of wine with dinner. I definitely saw the distinction between the two lifestyles. It quickly became very obvious that my dad had passed into alcoholism, and I kind of felt like after about fifth grade, it started to become like we were a prisoner in our own home. I started to not feel safe with my parents, and my mom did the best that she could for an untreated Al-Anon. She stayed with them. And I love my mom. We're best friends today, and I know she was just doing the best that she could with what she had. You know, and my dad really was a product of his environment. Came from a long line of alcoholics. Became an abusive drunk. We kind of had to walk on eggshells in our house. So getting to the age of about 12 years old, I realized that I could start to steal alcohol from my dad, and he wouldn't notice. And regardless of how much I took, he didn't notice. And that's how much he drank. We used to have stacks of Miller Lite and liquor bottles, like, to the end of the moon. I remember there was a crossover point where my mom asked me if I wanted to go to church or stay home with my dad. I was about 12 years old, and I made the choice to stay home with Pops. Because when Pops was in church, which he was banned from going to church, he was banned from going to our soccer games, he was not allowed to go to any of my sporting events because it was embarrassing. But he used to, you know, we grew up in a pretty traditional church. I'm not going to give away the denomination because I don't believe in doing that. I feel like people come into these meetings and they may have a faith and that could affect their faith, so I don't believe in doing that. But when the priest would dress up and they would go through the ceremonial stuff in the beginning of the church, my dad would go, "Abracadabra." And then he would grab one of our knees and kind of squeeze it. So my mom quickly said he wasn't allowed to come to church anymore. You know, I thought it was funny. And looking back on it, again, he was doing the best with what he had. No shame in that man's game. And he still makes me laugh to this day with some of the stuff he says. And I'll get to that. But yeah, I made that choice. I made a shift in my life where I was given a choice to either choose going to church or hanging out. And I chose to hang out. And I truly believe that that was the pivot point of my career that got me here. And again, I was given a choice. We're still given a choice. I get given a choice every day. I choose a different choice today. I choose the choice that y'all gave me here and the toolkit that you gave me here. Not too long after that, me and my buddy decided that it would be a good idea to drink a few shots of Canadian Mist and drive his parents' Chevette, which was a stick shift around the neighborhood when we were 12 years old. And I don't know how the hell we didn't get caught, because there was a lot of grinding of gears and revving of engines and ripping around the corners. It was nighttime. We were laughing and screaming. And we got away with it. And it was like, wow. You know, we didn't get completely totaled at that point, but that was my first experience with drinking, was doing something kind of adventurous, right? So I associated the two. Like, it was like I felt free and I could get away with doing dishonest stuff. And I don't know, it was kind of a thrill. So fast forward to the age of 15, the second time I decided to pick up alcohol was also with a friend that I played soccer with, and I drank to blackout. And that was pretty much the rest of my career with drinking. I would drink to blackout. From the age of 15 all the way through, you know, high school, through college, into my 30s, into my late 30s, I drank or used something to change the way that I felt for 24 years straight. So it's truly a miracle that I stand here sober, and I can tell you that I'm a testament to the fact that if I can do it, anyone can do it. It's just, it works 100% of the time when you work it. I somehow got through high school, almost got expelled my senior year by missed a lot of days, and then I got into a brutal fist fight in the lunchroom and put a kid in the hospital, and my mom got sued for the first time. There was other lawsuits. So I quickly became an angry kid. I mean, right at the age of 15 years old as well, kind of backing up, my mom caught my dad cheating on him, kicked him out of the house. He went out in a ball of fire. I was estranged from my dad from the time that I was 15 until I was in my 20s, and he lived less than a mile from my house. That kind of messed me up a little bit, not having him around, even though it was, you know, because I still had the memory of my pops when we grew up and bonded. That's the memory that I chose to hang on to. But I quickly became a pretty angry kid. You know, when your parent doesn't show up at your graduation or any of your stuff that's important to you, that matters. What I can gratefully share with you today is I show up for my kids' stuff. I enrolled my daughter into Paul Mitchell School of Cosmetology today, and that was a beautiful thing. So I was so happy to be able to be present for my daughter, and that is really the biggest gift that you guys have ever given me, is that I can be present for the people that love me and that I love, and I can pour into them, enroll into their visions, be genuinely interested in having heartfelt conversations with the people I love, and support them. And I got that here. And when I got here, I was not like that. I was very transactional. What can I get from you? like Miss Cat so pleasantly shared. Yeah, I was very transactional, if you can imagine what that picture looked like. You know, I was everybody's guy that they got the pot from. So I'm not going to talk about that a ton in here because I do understand this is an AA meeting, but I mean, you kind of opened the door for that one. So I'm going to go ahead and blame you. But yeah, so I did end up miraculously graduating high school. My mom was a school teacher in that system. She went and begged and pleaded with the principal that, you know, she pulled my ass through that place. Excuse my French. So thank God for my mom. She's always been one of my biggest fans. That lady never gave up on me. And so miraculously did that. I miraculously, eventually after traveling with the Grateful Dead and getting into the rave scene and doing a lot of undesirable things for after high school, I miraculously made it into college where I started my pot career and studying a bit and drinking and ended up finding some other dry goods in college that ended up paving the way for me to be, you know, to help me with my career in the field of, you know, that lifestyle. So my story is one of running. So the police got wind that I was growing and manufacturing and selling certain things I shouldn't have been doing in college, and I ended up having to bolt and just leave. Didn't get my degree, moved to Tennessee, and started my career of lying and on job resumes and getting jobs. So I portrayed that I had a degree, an associate degree in fish and wildlife management, but never actually attained that. But somehow was able to convince several employers that was me. And this was back in the day to where, I don't know why they didn't, I don't know whether it was that I pitched myself well, that I carried myself well, that I didn't have a ton on my criminal record at that time where I could get away with doing that, but somehow was able to portray someone who I wasn't. So I lived a lie. I quickly became a person that ran and lived a completely dishonest life. And so that's the way that I lived for quite a few many years. I met a girl, the children's mother, as I like to call her. We got together. We had a fabulously, you know, knockout, drag out, like terrible physical just relationship. And I say that is that, like, she used to physically punch me, and I thought that was suitable for like a healthy relationship, so I stayed. And and I think that does transcend back to growing up the way I did. I, you know, like, this is the best I'm gonna get, this is what I deserve, right? So I'm gonna stay in this because I really don't know what's well for me, what's good for me. So I stayed with her, decided to have a couple kids with her, got to a point where it got pretty bad. She left, which I don't blame her for doing. She left at around in 2006, and I didn't know where my kids were. So I came home to an empty house. She took everything. I was on vacation, a golf vacation, came back, and everything was gone. And so that was at that point, I had a roommate that was there, and he didn't call me to even tell me that she was leaving. So I came home, and he said, you know what, I'm moving out tomorrow. So then he moved out the next day. And so I'm in a house, you know, all by myself, left by myself, and you think that would be enough for me to stop, but no. I kept going for 4 more years after that. I quickly had 2 DUIs by the same cop on the same road within 30 days after they left. I think they were targeting me the second time. I was in the same vehicle. It was a big red Crittermobile. I run a pest control company and a wildlife company, which is now a very reputable company, and we're super blessed. But back then, It's like I was the creator guy on this same road, by the way, within the same mile stretch. So they got to know me really well around there. And God bless that police officer, because he kept showing up to court. Because the second time he got me, which was all his fault, by the way, you know, I had a full-on breakdown in the back of this guy's squad car and just bawling. Told him my whole story, you know, victim, victim, victim. This is what happened to me. How could they dare do this to me? You know, and very much lived that victim life. And he kept showing up. I hired some lawyers. You know, they drug it out for quite a few many years. I think by, when was it, 2011, it started to hit, and I couldn't go anywhere anymore. And on the second DUI, he pinned my ass down and said, this guy needs to go to AA. So he cared enough about me to know that I was the real deal. He knew it. And literally, I could shake his hand right now if I saw him. I didn't like him for quite a few many years. I spent a lot of money on that, and for the lawyers to say, you know what, you're kind of screwed. It cost me $11,000 to figure that out in 5 years, but I found you guys by the Fulton County court systems in 2011. That's how I ended up getting here. And I thank God for that. That's what I needed in order to plant the seed. And I came in and I got my paper signed and did my deal, sat in the back of the room, didn't get a sponsor, picked up some dirty chips for about a year. I thought you could be on, you know, other maintenance programs, but just not drink. And so I tried all those maintenance programs during that time, but that's what happens when you sponsor yourself in this program. And so I found out real quick that I needed to fire my sponsor. But I was able to get off of probation. And the crazy thing during this whole thing is how God was working in all of this is there was just so many signs. So I had my probation officer at that time knew I was full of it. And she took the paper that I got signed, and like I showed it to her, and the group that I was going to was the New Rush Hour Relief Group. It meets downtown Monday through Thursday, 6 to 7. It meets in Tate Hall at the Episcopal Church downtown. It's an amazing meeting. I was a token white guy at that meeting, and those guys are my freaking brothers, man. I love them to death. However, this, you know, my officer said, you know, I don't think that this is real. I don't know where you're getting these stamps from. I don't know who's signing it. That she saw right through me. And so she said, I want you to go back to this group and have them write a letter on your behalf saying that you've been going there. And so I returned back to this group, and I'm not participating in this group. They don't know me from a hole in the wall other than I just sit in the back of the room. And they're like, dude, like, we've never seen anybody have this request before. We don't need to sign this. But this is how good of a salesman I was. I convinced the guy to write the letter. And, you know, and I know that he did it out of the kindness of his heart, because he's a truly amazing human being, and he's one of my friends. But what it did was it allowed me to go get off of probation to go right back out and do what I was doing before. And that was my first experience with AA, is when I was sponsoring myself, I stayed the same, if not worse. So that was the first DUI. When the second one came around, I was pinned to the wall. In that particular case, I went to a... Back it up. So when the second one came around, I lost my license. Had to get a breathalyzer put on the vehicle. I had, at the time, I had a girlfriend that left me because she told me, if you start drinking again, I'm going to leave you, and she did. And I only did what I knew how to do, that I did my whole life, was reach back out for the solution, which was drugs and alcohol. So I had the binge of all binges that lasted about 3 days, and at the end of that binge, I was in my apartment all by myself. I had isolated to the point where I wasn't going out anymore, even though the few friends I had would call me out, hey, let's go to the clubs, and I'd say, yeah, I'll be right there, would never show up. I would just be in my apartment by myself, drinking and doing other things. And I had gotten myself into such a stupor that nothing was working anymore. The copious amounts of everything that I ingested had left me feeling like nothing is working to numb out the pain. My family was gone. You know, I had lost my license. I was on the way to losing my business. I was losing my health. I lost every sense of dignity that I had. And honestly, this girl leaving me was one of the biggest blessings, because she was the catalyst for change. At the time, I thought it was the worst thing that ever happened to me, but now that I reflect on it, but I was left with me and my 38 in my apartment. And I wanted to kill myself. You know, I was ready to do it, planning it out. And I just had a moment of clarity, and it was the first time that I had cried out to God. I don't know, ever since maybe I was a kid, I don't know, I don't have any memory of what that looked like, but I cried out to God and I asked him to help me. I said, I can't do this anymore. I need your help. And the next day I went to that same meeting that I was court ordered to go to, and when I walked into the meeting, it was like it was completely different. It felt different. The people seemed different. They actually genuinely seemed happy. And honestly, after the meeting, I had picked a white chip up, so I did what I was supposed to do, honestly, and I asked somebody to sponsor me the first meeting I went back. It was actually two guys sitting next to each other, and they both kind of looked at each other like, not it. Because I was known as the guy that came in with a mean look on his face for a year straight and just didn't contribute anything. And so, thank God, one of them said yes. His name was Derek, and I still talk to him to this day. And I would love to say that that was the last time that I picked up. But I went back home, and I had to hire a guy to drive me around in my company because I didn't have a license, right? So I hired a kid to drive me around. And I had some stuff I needed to get rid of. And I said, hey, man, you know, like, that will tell you up to that point I still had reservations, right? I look back at that knowing that since I still had those things, I hadn't really fully made a decision yet. So I gave these things to this kid and said, hey, you know what? He was like, hey, well, we might as well have one last rip off this bong, right? And I said, yeah, why not? And so we did, and even though I had made a decision and I got a sponsor, it was against my will. That I was completely powerless and that this stuff completely ruled my life, just like the drink and everything else had. And at that point in time, I realized that, you know, it was making the choices for me. So, like a good newcomer, and I called my sponsor about 2 days, 3 days later, and told him that I needed to change my sobriety date. And this man was such a beautiful, kind man, he said, you know what, that's just what we do. We need to do some work. You don't have a defense yet. He didn't shame me. He said, I'm going to change your sobriety date. Go pick up another white chip. We're going to do some work. So I started to meet up with him every week. And the first week I committed to was the same week that all that happened. I called him and said, hey, man, I got to cancel. I got to work late tonight. And he said, dude, like, if you don't show up for your sobriety, nobody else is going to show up for your sobriety. Like, either you need to get serious about this or you need to find another sponsor. Don't do this again. You need to make a commitment. You keep your commitment. I thank God for that, having sponsorship like that, because it's absolutely 100% true. Because there's a lot of times I don't feel like doing stuff, and you guys taught me how to show up and be committed. And it's super, super important. And I was never late for that man again. And we began to do some work. And the results at first were very painful. I felt like the first couple months were rough. You know, that getting sober stuff is freaking difficult. It's one of the most difficult things I've ever done in my life. But I called this man's phone a lot. And so eventually he told me, dude, you need to get other people's phone numbers. You need to get at least 5 phone numbers of guys that you know and, like, build some friendships and fellowship in this deal. Like, you need to get fellowship outside of meetings. And so that's what he taught me, is that, yes, there's magic that happens in these meetings, but the real magic is when you apply those things out in the real world and you build truthful, real friendships. And those honestly saved my ass until I got a program. And so I began to reach out to other men, and I got to experience their sobriety, and we got to experience each other's sobriety. And when we got to the third step, and me and my sponsor kneeled, and we held hands, and we said the third step prayer, that was the first time that I'd been intimate with another man, and that vulnerable to do something like that. Something shifted at that point. And I realized that God can, right? And he will, if I let him. And we began to go into those inventory steps. And I was as honest as I could be at that time. I've done some other seasonal house cleaning since then, but I wrote 28 pages of stuff. And, I mean, we started to see some patterns after a little while. They were kind of repetitive, but it all stemmed back to my dad. And I realized that every relationship that I built was built on fear of abandonment, fear of judgment, you know, a lot of these things that I experienced with my dad that I'd never forgiven him for were showing up in all my relationships. And so it was bigger than the drinking and the other things. It was why I drank and how I felt inside and the brokenness that I carried around with me for so long. And I began to share these things. After I wrote it out, I shared it with my sponsor, and as graceful as he was, he told me all the screwed up stuff he did too, and I'm like, whoa, dude, you're like, those are some pretty messed up things you did. And so it made me associate, and it made me feel at home to where I wasn't alone. And I began to share more intimately and more vulnerably with the other men that I was were in my network, and we told each other things. And so that was another inventory process that was really powerful for me and still is very powerful for me today, is sharing my heart with men and listening to their hearts and enrolling in their dreams and encouraging them to go for them. Because that's what we do here. We get all that stuff out of the way and we get to live our life, like our authentic self, the way we were meant to live. We get to do that here. And that's so very special to me. And, you know, this step 6 and 7 it's a lifetime deal, but one of the things that he told me, Jay, it's my job to take you through the steps, and it's God's job to do the rest. And I want to get you connected with God, and he's going to remove these things. And they're going to come back, and you're going to ask him to remove them again, and he's going to remove them again. And as willing as you are to have these things removed, to shift and to step into your authentic self, the more you're going to be able to shift quicker and shift quicker and shift quicker. And that's been my experience, is that I get to shift a lot quicker the more I'm connected to you guys. I don't have to live in that wall or that, you know, that block that I put up between 2 and 5 years old or somewhere along in that line that stopped me from being me. And so I set out to make my amends. I had 2 weeks. He said, you got 2 weeks, buddy. And I had a pretty freaking big list. So I knocked them out. What I could knock out, we had made an agreement. Like, these are the ones you can do. These are the ones you probably should never do unless you run into these people, because you might mess their lives up. And, you know, we had a priority, and I got through as many as I possibly could. And it made me human again, where I started to care about people and the harms that I did to these people, and I started to be able to reconcile that and make an attempt to repair it and to let them know I was wrong and the way that I treated them was wrong. And it was either selfish, dishonesty, you know, self-seeking, inconsiderate, fear, one of those things that, those five things that is always the deal in here, which I base all of my trigger decisions out of. Those are my triggers, right? Those are not what I authentically am. And that process, it started to feel like I was human and I could actually look you in the eyes again and smile. And then, you know, then we go back to inventory again. I'm like, more inventory, right? There seems to be more inventory steps in this program than anything else. And I think it's for a reason. It's because I need to work on me. And as long as I work on me and I care about you, I stay sober. If I try to work on you and care about me, I get thirsty. That's just the way that it is. It's a miracle that the obsession has been lifted from me today, but the allergy will forever be there, and I know that if I decide to make a bad decision, it's going to call the shots. But what I have the best defense against is the mental and the spiritual aspect of this disease. So I try to stay fit. I was taught in those growth steps, as I like to call them, to have a daily discipline of waking up, meditating, praying, reading some spiritual literature, reaching out to some alcoholics. I like to make daily declarations, too. That's one thing I've added. This is who I am. You know, I'm a giving, joyous, and free man. That's my contract with God. And if I'm not living in that contract, like, I know what I have to do. But I declare that every day in the morning now, and I write down what I'm going to create in the world. So I am creating connection. I'm creating love with other human beings. I'm creating servant leadership. These are the things that I get to create today. And I get to declare that, and I get to act on it, and I get to live in it. And I'm not going to be perfect, but I got a better chance when I know who I am and why I'm living. Because I'm not defined by my past and my, you know, mistakes, but I look at them as my greatest assets today because I get to use them to help other people. And so that spiritual fitness has been a game changer for me. Those spot check inventories during the day seem to be the most difficult part about that step. One of the things I like to do is set the alarm on my phone to remind me to pray and to take a break every once in a while. And to take it easy. I'll set some spiritual literature on the desk at my work, and I'll remind myself that I need to maybe read a few pages of that stuff, that I need to call somebody. So I have to set alarms against myself. And this is after 13 years of sobriety. I still do this stuff because I know I need to do it. And I also have a ton of people that hold me accountable in my life, one of which is my wife. She will call me out at every waking moment. I surround myself with people that tell me the truth. I love honest feedback. If it makes me pissed off, it's probably true. And then I got to take a look at that. Nighttime inventory and prayer process is very sacred to me. It started out with all the stuff I did wrong during the day. And that asset and liability category was a little lopsided when I first got here. And then I realized that I needed to really start loving myself more and talk to myself and to acknowledge myself for the things that I did well that day, which is really my favorite part of every day, is talking about how well I do. Because, you know, very full of myself. So, but that's okay too. I get to say, you know, what did I do good today? Who did I help? Who did I give an encouraging word to? Who did I get to enroll in their vision and get them to believe in what they're doing? What meaningful conversation did I have with someone today about their family or what their passions are? What their interests are, what they want to do within the community, how they interacted with their family that day. Those are the things I like reviewing at night, and I can smile and go to bed knowing that I made an attempt to affect someone's life that day. And so very much that discipline has been the difference maker for me with what you guys taught me, and that's my sponsor taught me that from the beginning. He said, you need to read 86 through 89 every day. I know you're not on step 10, 11, and 12 yet, but you're going to do this every day because if you don't do this, you're probably not going to stay sober. So you need to put your big book where you used to have the stuff that you reached for every day. So it reminds you to read and do what you're supposed to do. So I've imprinted those pages into my mind. They're amazing. It is a way of living. It works every single time. And now I get to carry the message to you guys and practice these principles in all my affairs. And that last part of that step is key. Sure, I can practice it with you guys, but can I practice it with my family and the people that I work with? The people that really trigger me. Can I do it with them too? And I'm happy to report I can when I want to. And today, I have custody of both my girls. I got custody of them 4 years ago. And unfortunately, their mother's out there doing what we used to do. And we really don't know how she's doing or where she's at. But my girls are with me and they're safe. So I get to provide a safe home for them on what a healthy marriage looks like and how a spiritual person lives. And that's something I never got from my dad, and I get to provide that for my girls, and that's one of the biggest gifts that I could ever ask for. I don't really care about the rest. The byproduct of that is that I run a very successful company, and we're very blessed. It's 10x since I got in here. I've got an amazing, beautiful wife. I've got a huge network of friends. I get to participate in two nonprofits, and they trust me with the money somehow. I get to count money sometimes, and you know, of course, the joke's always got to fly. You remember you used to do this, you know, back when you're the dope man, you count lots of money, we laugh and stuff, you know, it's funny, and all the money shows up in it, or whatever, but I love that. There's just so many fruits of this program, but I will say the biggest fruit of this program for me has been the relationships that I have with others, the relationship I have with God, and the relationship that I have with myself. Thanks.
Thank you, Jay. That was amazing.
First I slip, and then I trip to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me. Look into life's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promise is. All is. Sometimes quickly. Sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, God wants us, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for our heart. Take me where the promises are